Happy Wacky Wednesday. It is Wednesday, May 1st, May Day, Beltane 2019, and time for another edition of Blackbird Nine's Breakfast Hulk, Breakfast Club. Try that again. I'm your host, Frederick C. Blackburn. I'd like to welcome everyone to the Trading Post this evening. I hope everyone's having a wonderful Wacky Wednesday and a wonderful week so far. Tonight's episode is episode 157 and is entitled Jan Lambre Signals Mayday on Beltane. Jan Lambre Signals Mayday on Beltane. And as a special treat, we finally got all of our wires connected. Mr. Jan Lambre, our Breakfast Club Pathfinder from South Africa, one of our South Africa Pathfinders, is going to be joining us, and we'll be talking about his current North American tour. So I'm sure many of the listeners are aware that he got into the country a couple of weeks ago and was one of the presenters at the Bash Fest 2019 get-together up there in Pennsylvania. And a lot of good people on the bill, like Miss Monica Schaefer, Mr. Eli James, and Mr. Brian Rue. And so he's going to be telling us about that, and also doing a lot of other speaking engagements, mainly in the U.S. and Canada. So he's going to be on second hour to talk more about that. So we're real excited about having him back on the show. It's been a while since he's been on the show. And remember, you Pathfinders, you know, welcome. You're always welcome to come on the show and let everybody know what you're doing. That's part of the Pathfinder model. So other than that, absolutely nothing going on. So we really don't have any news whatsoever to talk about first hour, right? So, anyway, if you'd like to join us, you can come out to the chat room at bb9tradingpost.chitango.com. That's bb9tradingpost.chitango.com. Got quite the crew in there already this evening. Let's see here. We got Mr. Amos Amish 2 is here. And Mr. Detox the Kool-Aid. And we need to get rid of that right away. Bad pre-production. Bad pre-production. Never on the beat. Okay, try this again. Mr. Detox the Kool-Aid, welcome, good sir. George 1951, Mr. Jim Fire, Miss Mer Bailey, Miss Snippets, thank you for the wonderful cartoons this week. Those were some really good ones. A lot of material there. Like I said, absolutely nothing going on this week, so the cartoonists have absolutely nothing to draw, right? Umberto 1010, Mr. Windmiller, Wolfgang, and several lurkers. Got reprimanded, not reprimanded, but just a heads up on the Anon Chitango shows, like we were talking about last week, shows people that are just in the chat room but haven't chosen an avatar as being anonymous. So our anonymous people, welcome. First rule of Breakfast Club is be nice to newbies. Second rule of Breakfast Club is everyone's a newbie. So that said, oh, Wolfgang's here. I got. And I just stumbled in. Welcome. Oh, lots of people showing in. Anyway, so, of course, as mandated by, I'm sure, some law somewhere, we have to first acknowledge that this is yet another Holocaust, Holocaust, whatever you want to call it, but it is yet another, not only Memorial Day, but Remembrance Week. So you have the Holocaust month, you have the Holocaust Remembrance Days, and you get the Holocaust Remembrance Week. So I hope everyone's doing due diligence out there and making sure that everybody is well informed of what the Holocaust is all about. And, I, of course, have been having fun with the local experts here at our Judaic Holocaust and Peace Study Center at Appalachian State University. Some of my favorite carpetbaggers here in the high country have moved in and established themselves as being the moral, ethical, and intellectual authority on all matters. Mr. Hanshan 99 is with us, so welcome. But just the having lots of fun posting to social media and tagging all the experts at Appalachian State University about the reality of the Holocaust industry and that, what they're doing. Yeah, it's very strategic. This was very well mapped out with these, how to destroy the southern United States. And, the Marxists long knew, you get to the children because, the children are trusting. They believe the teachers are telling them the truth, that the teachers and the professors have their well-being and at heart, et cetera. And, teachers couldn't tell you anything if it wasn't true. And the sad part is, they've moved in, set up this, training center because remember Appalachian State University before it was a sports ball, breeding ground for the National Felon League, and the national, the basketball version of the National Felon League, and we got all our diversity. It started out as a teachers' college. The idea was to train teachers in these mountains how to go back to their communities and teach the children how to read, write, do logic so that they can take their place in the great experiment. You used to teach things like civics, how to be part of your government. And we'll talk about the congressional and Senate hearings on the Mueller report later, but that's part of civics. I think Mr. Congress Critter Nadler needs to remember his Robert Rules of Order from today's outburst, which was, you got to be careful who you give a gavel to in these things. But anyway, Appalachian started out to be a teacher's college, to teach, white Christian people that settled these mountains, fair trade it with these mountains. I hate it when people start saying, oh, you stole those mountains from those Native Americans. And it's like, no, 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 no. Europeans were here with the Clovis tribes in these mountains long before the Cherokee even started wandering across. But, it was to bring education back into the communities and improve education in the great experiment. That was what Appalachian State University is for. And now, it is nothing but a cultural Marxist brainwashing center. I mean, it is amazing. This is textbook 101 brainwashing strategies that they are using. You can go through all the great Jewish scientists that developed these things from the Solomon Asch experiments on group conformity to the the authority experiments, etc. And you see them doing this to these children and turning them into little social justice warrior, non-player characters that all they can do is react and parrot, what they've been taught. And the big thing is in that cultural Marxist model, remember the other part is to destroy the family unit. So the first things these, cultural Marxist teachers do is shame these kids to make them ashamed of their families, that their family does everything wrong, especially the father. And what, then you get into the whole race construct of, white people alone are uniquely responsible for every bad thing that's ever happened in the world and owe everybody else reparations, especially the Jews. No one has suffered like the Jews. And so when you have Holocaust Week, then you get all this mandated education stuff that's funded a lot by out-of-state, out-of-country grant money. It's like, oh, we've got a special grant to do this special program for the children, you know, to make sure that they understand the Holocaust and that Jewish suffering is unique. And so it's the psychological, you know, manipulation of trauma-based programming. And it's all based on a pack of lies. And, but like Bolshevik terrorist, you know, Vladimir Lenin said, you know, a lie repeated often enough becomes the truth. This is Pavlovian conditioning, you know, and it has the added aspect of, you know, they are brainwashing these poor white children, into thinking that they are personally responsible and that they suffer. This is like Munchausen syndrome, there's actually a thing scientifically, you know, identified as irrational anti-Semitism, and all white people are infected with it. And this is the terminology they use over here. And of course, all these, you know, politically correct students are just sitting there, you know, believing everything to be true and eating it up. And they just pour it on harder and harder. And the kids are sitting there getting shamed. And it's like, well, my father fought in war, or, you know, now it's, you know, my grandfather and my great-grandfather fought in World War II. And, you know, you never get a thank you. And, you know, that was one of the messages that I sent over to ASU, was a cartoon of U.S. military invading Germany. And during D-Day, and talking about, you know, what the future is going to be, and, you know, they're attacking the Germans saying, "Die, Nazi," and then it shows present day of what the future is, and it's a college campus full of Black Lives Matter, Antifa types, you know, openly communist, telling this World War II vet in a wheelchair, and this Antifa kid is punching him in the face and knocking his World War II hat off. My dad always had one of those World War II veteran hats he wore everywhere. You know, punching him in the face, saying, "Die, Nazi." And, you know, that is the thing that I want, you know, that staff over there to understand is, you know, my father, who was from these Appalachian mountains, going, you know, that family line goes back to colonial days. And he and his brothers and my uncles, et cetera, you know, all fought in that war. And never once did my father, and we talked about this, when I was always, you know, in those last years, you know, wanting to see, you know, where he was on the JQ and everything. And, you know, the whole thing of what World War II was about. And, you know, one of the comments he would make was, you know, that he had never, ever had a Jew thank him for serving in World War II. You know, he had lots of other people. That's one of the things about wearing that hat. You know, total strangers come up and thank you for fighting in the good war, you know. But, you know, he made a point to say that, you know, no Jewish person has ever thanked me. He said a lot of them, you know, would say something snide about it took you long enough and we were suffering and we were in the gas chambers and, you know, it took you forever to rescue us. But, you know, 6 million of us had already perished, etc. And that's the mentality of this, you know, the eternal innocent victim that can never do any wrong and sees an advantage of shaming their target, you know. And, you know, my father is the poster child of what that Appalachian State University and all of these North Carolina State universities, pretty much all the universities in, you know, the United States and Europe now, you know, they want that, you know, dominant white male alpha male. They want them completely emasculated, shamed, broken, so that they can take over and, you know, push in the Kalari plan. And they use this whole thing of, you know, racism and diversity and tolerance to do it. But it's just, you know, say it what it is. This is a psychological warfare program being run on school teachers that will then, if you look at this from a fourth generation asymmetrical nonlinear warfare model of cell warfares, you know, that mind virus from those thought leaders then gets propagated in an exponential pattern to all the, you know, local schools. So, you know, you bring the teachers in, you brainwash them, and then they go and parrot what they were taught with all the trauma and all the special tales from all of the Confederates in the audience. That's one of the other things I notice about, you know, all these symposiums they put on, is every Jew within 5 miles of ASU is going to be there to back up the official story and attack anybody who dares question it, and do that immediate whisper campaign. You know, the second somebody walks in and says, I have questions about this, they're immediately tagged and targeted, and they go around whispering, like, oh, see that guy over there? You don't want to listen to anything he says. He's a bad person. He's an anti-Semite. He's a racist. He's a Nazi, whatever. And of course, you know, the gullible student teachers are, you know, oh, thanks for the heads up. Y'all be sure not to listen to anything they say. And then, of course, you have the one or two that always come up and make a point to get in your face, you know, that, you know, they're going to take you out in front of everybody. That's the way the model works. And of course, it gets back to that let's you and them fight model. And yeah, so you just see that agitating between the politically correct social justice warrior NPC teacher and the indigenous white Christian population of the area. That is the target that these cultural Marxists are being focused on. And, you know, they're going to go correct the thinking of all those young white children so that they don't think wrong thoughts like their parents and grandparents did. And, you know, that is the teacher shroud of virtue that is, you know, so crazy making in this education system, is that they think that they are just doing holy work here by fixing these children. They're not trying to teach them anymore. You know, they are trying to, you know, mold their thinking process, not teaching them how to think, but teaching them what to think. And so, you know, so it has been good this week to be able to once again, you know, hit it back to them. That's the thing, is when they throw these things out, take it and use it to your advantage. It's like, you open that door, you want to go there, let's go there. You know, and one of the big things that I like to do here is, because Appalachian State University is such a feminist hotbed, you know, you just have this radical feminism in these mountains, all these carpet-bagging Jews coming in and, you know, radicalizing all the women to say, do you realize that you're a victim? You know, you're a victim of the toxic matriarchy. And they're like, oh, I thought I was, you know, I was loved in my family. Oh, no, you know, you're being oppressed. And you know, that is the key to this model up here, is just, you know, because the majority of teachers now are women. You, and the few men that go into teaching, you know, have been completely neutered for the most part. The only time you get to have anybody who's not neutered is usually a, you know, non-white in a coaching position or position of power. But as far as just your standard classroom teachers, it's, you know, mainly women now. And so you get them all radicalized, and, you know, these poor young men in these classrooms don't stand a chance. It is just amazing how much these, you know, teachers are emasculating these young men and completely shaming them for sticking up for themselves. You know, that you're supposed to be feeling this guilt for what happened to the Jews and how men completely ruined everything when they were building Western civilization, right? And but that is the, you know, mindset. So, you know, one of the things I like to do is the chancellor over here, Chancellor Sherry Everetts, or Jezebel as I call her, as a carpetbagger, she came in to fix the white problem of Watauga County. You know, Appalachian State University was too white. She was there to make global citizens out of the student body. That was her mission statement. And she had a ton of backup, both from the state and from all of this outside money. She was put in place to do this. This was part of that fifth column. And her other big champion is girl power. Everything's like, you know, girl power this, girl power that, girl power this. You know, looking out for the rights of women everywhere. And all of the university press, the covers are always women on the cover doing something. You know, if there are any men, they're always men of color. You never see a North Carolina white Christian straight man on the cover in a positive role in any Appalachian State or UNC, University of North Carolina, network propaganda. And they spend tons on this propaganda. Just ask anybody who's alumni. You're constantly getting these glossy magazines to say, look what we're doing, send us money. You know, that's how that whole marketing thing of alumni is, you know, you need to send your alma mater money so we can continue doing our good work. And so that they're always, you know, making all of these statements about women around the world and sticking up for women's rights around the world. And so, you know, bring up the Ursula Haverbeck that, you know, Ursula Haverbeck is in prison for questioning history. You know, Monica Schaefer was in prison for questioning history. Sylvia Stoles was in prison for representing someone who questioned history. You know, how can these thought leaders, you know, like Sherry Jezebel Evarts, you know, how can you stay silent with all of this? And so, we always say borrow a page from your enemy's playbook. You know, one of the things about Saul Alinsky's Rules for Radicals is those very basic techniques are very effective, you know, especially the one of make your enemy live up to their own set of rules. And so this whole thing about girl power, you know, is perfect for, you know, bringing up all of our truth lions in the, you know, truth movement that are in cages for merely advocating for the truth. And you just hit them with that and hit them with that and never let go. And like I said, you know, bring on all of these Holocaust remembrance weeks and days, you know, because we can use it to our advantage to wake up the normies, as we say. So the other thing that was so over the top with this was that Florida announced... Florida announced this week in the wake of the synagogue shooting, you know, it's like, oh, that was so much more important than the any of the Christians that are being massacred around the world. But this is coming out of Russia Today. It says Florida cites Poway shooting to pass controversial anti-Semitism bill. Just days after the fatal shooting at a California synagogue, the Florida Senate passed an anti-Semitism bill that critics say will criminalize any criticism of Israel. And this is what the Bolsheviks did. You know, they just kind of came in and said, you can't criticize Jews. You know, they made up the term, like racist, anti-Semitism, to say that is criticism of the Jews. And under Noahide law and under Bolshevik law, you know, that is illegal and a death sentence. So eventually they get enough power, they start, you know, enforcing their game rules that says any questioning of Jewish authority is a death sentence. That is the heart of Noahide law. And you can best believe that when they get enough power like they did during the Bolshevik Revolution, the Holodomor, and the Armenian genocide, that, you know, they're going to start enforcing Talmudic law. Right now, they're just, you know, saying, oh, we're going to have punitive measures. And it says the bill prohibits anti-Semitism in Florida public schools and university and defines it broadly as any speech that makes stereotypical depictions of Jews, Holocaust denial, inciting of violence, or explicit expression of racial hatred, as well as criticizing the collective power of the Jewish community. You know, so you can't even criticize Judaism as a power system. you know, that they have a collective power in the various industries, like the banking industry, the media industry, et cetera. So, you know, this is in Florida, so it's coming, and you know, that's how much power the Jews in Florida, you know, that's the big thing is, you know, then going to establishing Hollywood, and then the other part went down to Miami in Florida and set up that big power system there. Also, the development in the Jewish mob in Cuba, especially around Havana, before Castro threw them all out and they all went to Florida. And so you've got all of these, you know, radical Jews, Zionists, you know, Chabad, Lubavitch, you know, we are the master race, you know, being thrown out of Cuba and setting up shop in Florida and basically doing what they do is, you know, becoming brokers of power. And so they're making the laws that benefit them, and, you know, who's always going to be the targets? You know, those evil white people that still want to run their own nations rather than giving over to allowing the Jews to run the entire world under their Talmudic Noahide law model in Greater Israel and Pax Judaica. So I thought that was a bit over the top. Now, I guess, you know, what everyone's looking at is the University of North Carolina at Charlotte. Charlotte is our largest city, big banking hub in Charlotte. And yesterday, on the last day of lectures at the university there, we had another shooting, and two students lost their lives. And had it pulled up, and yeah, it was really a study in media to watch the story unfold, because the first breaking news was, this was happening yesterday afternoon, was that a white student shooter had opened fire at the university in Charlotte. So immediately everybody jumped onto this, you know, white Southern, you know, neo-Nazi, white supremacist, etc. And you saw all of that churning up. That is the de facto that the Jewish media at all levels, from, you know, CNN, MSNBC, BBC, all the way down to Pravda Wataga, i.e. the Adams Publishing Company, Wataga Democrat. Yeah, this is all Mockingbird, and that's what they're going to lead with. You know, even if they slowly back off of it later, which they did, you know, that is what they're going to lead with, is out there that a white male shooter at a Southern college has started killing people. And then all the people start saying, well, it looks like we have another case of a white supremacist. This is Charlottesville all over again. And, you know, that was what they led with. But then the report started coming in that this person, Terrell, what's his first name? Been following this for days. Tristan Terrell, excuse me, just totally went blank there, but Tristan Terrell, who's 22-year-old, this is coming from the Daily Mail in the UK. So this, you know, was in Russia Today, this was on the BBC, this just really went viral. But then this morning when we got up, the story had pretty much disappeared. And it's because it wasn't the right identity politics, and the victims were the wrong victims. So basically you have this, you know, Tristan Terrell person who they won't say he is non-white. You know, they just keep saying, you know, white shooter. But, you know, he definitely does not look like he's completely white. Now, I could be wrong on that. You know, there's a big grayscale of whiteness, right? But that they immediately backed off the identity politics, so you get nothing about his identity. And, yeah, there was some chatter, you know, about if, you know, is this student a Muslim student? We saw some of that. And of course, they're being conspicuous by its absence of no data. And, you know, you think if this had been the right identity politics, they would have been all over this, that there was a white Christian male neo-Nazi white supremacist with, you know, ties to extremist groups and, you know, white supremacy groups, etc. You know, they posted a naughty Holocaust cartoon on Twitter one time, you know, basically giving them the, you know, Charlottesville treatment, you know, over this, but then they backed off of that. And the other thing that I saw in the narrative now is they're trying to make the case that he suffers from autism. So, you know, you always have, if it's anybody but a white, straight white guy, then there's got to be, you know, some medical reason, etc. And so you start getting into the Michael Kadar sympathy thing that, oh, this is just a tragic event. There was no underlying hate crime here. The two young men killed were very white. Riley Howe, 21, and Ellis Parlier, 19, who died from their wounds. And saying that Riley Howe was the one who tackled him, Terrell, to keep him from attacking more people. And so you have that slant to the story. But it was fascinating to watch the response from Appalachian State University, who immediately sent out this, you know, we stand in solidarity, you know, our a fellow school in Charlotte, etc. And then when the demographics started changing, then they just really backed off of it. And suddenly it's just when the Chancellor Jezebel did her statement, she was talking about, I'll just read it, and, you know, compare this to how she described James Fields in Charlottesville with all the, you know, there's no room for hate here. You know, this is racism. There's no room for, you know, white supremacy, etc. on campuses. And of course, it's taking forever to load. Firefox not responding. I love live radio. Anyway, so, you know, the point I'm making is that this is not letting me pull up the actual quote, so I'm paraphrasing, but basically both the Watauga Democrat and the Appalachian administration just did this. It's just a tragic, senseless event that these students died, these students were injured. But anyway, so we're just going to move on. Firefox doesn't want to play nice. Hopefully we're still going out. I wish I had lots of money to buy a really nice computer that was fast enough to keep up with the show. On that note, I would like to say thank you for all the people who donated to the show, hit the tip jar this week. That was really appreciated, especially here at the first of the month when we have all of our bills coming due. So the tip jar, that was very nice this week. So thanks again to all who donated. So here we go. This is, of course, from our little Trotskyite, Kayla LeSueur at Pravda Watauga. It says, local state leaders react to UNC Charlotte campus shooting. And, of course, they've immediately come up with the logo of the Niner Nation Unites, and they're, you know, doing the whole NPC social justice warrior thing about this. Now, not to be the cynic, but one of the things about Charlotte these days, so Charlotte used to be a white southern city. When I was growing up, you know, you went to Charlotte to go shopping and to go do business, etc., and it was a clean, white, you know, crime-free city. Now, since we have all this wonderful diversity and we have over 1,000 people a day from all over the world moving into Charlotte, it is no longer a white city. And amazingly, we are now becoming Little Chicago. So every night on the local news, it's somebody got shot in Charlotte today. Somebody got murdered or stabbed in Charlotte today. So it's like Sweden, it's like France, it's like Germany, it's like London, it's like the rest of the UK, you know, Birmingham, Blackburn, all those formerly white areas. Suddenly you have all of this crime. So that, you know, there's this, well, if all lives matter and, you know, why is this event so different from every other day in Charlotte, except for this has great potential for propaganda, especially if it's the right identity politics. So, this is maddening. Okay. Appalachian State University posted to social media soon after the tragedy to express the deep sadness it felt for its sister institution and stated it held the UNCC community in our hearts and thoughts this evening. Quote, we grieve for the victims of this tragedy and their families as well as the entire Niner Nation, said App State Chancellor Sherry Everett in a statement on May 1st. Today and in the challenging days ahead, Mountaineers are in solidarity with UNC Charlotte and those affected by this devastating violence. Okay, so at no point do they even hint that this might be anything besides just a random shooting. You know, that's my point, is if this had been a white student who was targeting Muslim students or black students or Jewish students, you know, they would be screeching their heads off about it. But this is just showing what their policies are doing to these universities. You know, if you're going to politicize, agitate, weaponized students with all this cultural Marxism, this is what you get. If you are going to destroy the existing civilized systems of these towns, break down their social cohesion with clergy plan diversity and all of these immigrants coming in from everywhere. And again, you know, this guy is not from North Carolina. Yeah, you know, he moved here from Texas, but you know, what is the family history? We don't know. they're being very, very secretive with the identity politics of this matter. But, again, my point is this is being reduced to, like, Adam Curtis would say, just the oh dear syndrome. It's just, oh, just more chaos and mayhem today. Can't do anything about it. Oh dear. Rather than the, oh, this is, identity politics playing out. This is a direct result of our Kalergi plan diversity plans that we are doing to education and the state. This is the result. And the problem is everybody who designed this knew this would be the result. This is the desired result. It's not supposed to work. It's supposed to fail so it can be replaced with another system. And that is the, big point of these type of events is, like Rahm Emanuel said, you never let a good crisis go to waste. Now, okay. Okay, this is just not going to play nicely. I apologize. So I'm just going to go from my notes here since I can't pull up the articles. One of the big stories, of course, following is the Julian Assange extradition and trials. And so just quick update on that was he was sentenced to 50 weeks in jail for skipping out on the court proceedings. And so, that's the first set of charges against him. So it's like, okay, for this, we're going to charge you, 50, sentence you to 50 weeks for this part of it. So it's going to be interesting to see how much of these charges continue to ramp up. Is he going to be extradited to the United States to testify? So, always keep in mind that, there's a connection between everything that's going on with Julian Assange, WikiLeaks, Hillary Clinton, the Podestas, the Jeffrey Epstein, the Lolita Express, the Pleasure Sex Slave Island, Pizzagate, Seth Rich, this is all connected. So, so Julian Assange is a player in play. He has been sentenced to, 50 weeks. Meanwhile, today in the United States, several of us got together and watched the Senate hearings, and it was amazing to, this was the U.S. Senate hearings on the Robert Mueller report with Attorney General William Barr. And I thought, William Barr held up very well. I thought he handled himself very well. And it was very telling to watch the Senate leaders from the Democratic side, or the Democrat side, just their mannerisms, their tone. It was just amazing to me that the chairperson, Senator Lindsey Graham from South Carolina, did not gavel down a couple of the tirades, and that's all you could basically call them, from some of these so-called Senate leaders. And of course, this goes back to law school 101. If you've got the facts in a law case, argue the facts. If you don't have the facts or the evidence, then you argue the law. If you don't have the facts, evidence, or the law, then you attack the person. That's the ad hominem attack. And if you can't attack the person, then you just shout loudly and pound your fist on the desk. And it was amazing just having a sitting U.S. senator, and this is, the senator from Hawaii, Hirono. She's a Democratic senator, and she wasn't born in the United States. She was born in Japan. Another one of these, rapid track Democrats. It's amazing that when I was trying to do a career in politics, I started out stuffing, mailers and flyers and, going out and canvassing neighborhoods, at the precinct level. And, you work your way up through the precincts, through your districts, through, your state level to your national level politics. And, it's like you're trying to get people to know you so that they will help finance your campaigns, et cetera. And it's like, who are these people that just move into my country and suddenly they have seats on the highest councils in the land, the U.S. Senate? How do you just become a U.S. senator? And it's the same thing with this last round of elections with all these new congresswomen, that, they're not from here. They do not care anything about the great experiment or rule of law. They just want identity politics and bringing in more of their kind to establish their systems. They are here to break the system. It's like, who is behind this? So when I was listening to her go on and calling the president of the United States a grifter and a liar on the record, and that the chair, exercised such restraint by, letting them speak, and not gaveling them down. I would not, I don't know if I would have, probably would have worn out my gavel and had a few people removed. But it's like definitely, the total disrespect of just the rules of order by, people like, Spartacus Booker. He was just so rude and arrogant and disrespectful to the time. It was interesting who respected their time limits and who just constantly ran over their time limits. And it's like, that's the big thing about parliamentary procedures is, Robert's Rules of Orders, you got to obey those rules. And it was like these people were flaunting it just to attack the system and attack the report and attack the messenger of Mr. Barr. And there was so many cases of the, Kafka trap type questioning that had nothing to do with anything other than asking, the person basically the equivalent of, "Are you still beating your wife?" There's no way you can answer these type of questions with a yes or no answer. They're a paradoxical question to self-incriminate. And a good chairperson usually will identify and say, "That question is out of order. We see what you're doing," and that the chair wasn't defending the person being questioned from those kind of attacks. I thought Mr. Barr did very well defending himself, but it was amazing to watch this so-called hearing, and it was nothing but trying desperately to come up with something to establish that there was still criminal activity from the Trump administration and to shield Hillary Clinton's emails. And that's one of the things they kept coming around to is, you people are just trying to go after Hillary Clinton's emails. And, Barr's sitting there saying, no, this was an investigation to see if there was Russian collusion in the election with President Trump. And one of my biggest takeaways of this was part of the procedure of the FBI and the Department of Justice from a security standpoint is once the FBI establishes that an American citizen is a targeted individual of a foreign power, be it, an out-of-state country, or I mean, another country, a international business, a criminal syndicate, whatever. If a U.S. citizen has become a target, a person of interest to any of those type of systems, The standard procedure is the FBI contacts the person to let them know that they are a targeted individual and that, you know, to inform them of the risk analysis of the particular situation. That the FBI knew and it established that President Trump had and his campaign had become a targeted individual, you know, a group of interest, you know, he in particular, by a foreign entity, he was not debriefed. That he was, you know, that was, you know, that courtesy was not extended to President Trump. And you know, this is a huge point. It may sound a little technical, but as far as, you know, surveillance laws in this country, you know, that is key, that he was not granted that standard procedure. And I think that is one of my biggest takeaways for this whole thing, was that, okay, if you thought he was, you know, being targeted, why didn't you warn him? And so, you know, there's the case is, was the Department of Justice and the FBI weaponized under President Obama against President Trump? You know, this is, you know, the root of the matter, and that, you know, you had the Fusion GPS group pay Christopher Steele to create the dossier to point the finger, and that, you know, this all comes back to the Clinton Foundation, etc. You know, that is the smoking gun of this, you know, but they are still trying to make the case that Trump is just an evil white guy that needs to be removed from office. And they're, you know, trying to get impeachment proceedings based on this incident, but there's nothing there. And that's what, you know, they keep saying is, you know, the Department of Justice found nothing to give any type of movement towards impeachment any credibility. And so just that typical cultural Marxist thing is star chamber justice is he's guilty, you know, don't argue the facts. You know, we just need to get him out of the way. You know, this, you're guilty and you can't prove yourself innocent. And you know, we just need to have a sham court, you know, a witch hunt, witch trials, etc. We need to have our own little Nuremberg here to take Trump out. And so that was what was rumbling in the House today in their hearings. And there, unlike, you know, Lindsey Graham, the senator from South Carolina, was the chair of this hearing for the Senate. Jared Nadler, echo, was the chair of the House hearings, and it was complete chaos. I have never, it's been a while since I've seen a parliamentary procedure in the United States just completely lose order and descend into chaos like the House hearings today. He was going in, he had an agenda, he was completely out of order on so many procedures, from discussion of votes, identifying whether a vote actually passed based on the numbers. You know, it's just, you know, it was painful to watch. But if you haven't seen it, go out and watch the congressional hearings today and see how Nadler behaved as chair in those. That was, you know, of course, the judiciary hearings from the House. And I guess the other big story that everybody's watching is, of course, Venezuela. One of the things that's very telling to me that I always go back to is that about 2016-2017, Jews were leaving en masse from Venezuela because the government was cracking down on their activities. And of course, the Jews were, you know, claiming victimhood, but it's basically the same things that they always do that gets them run out of countries. And so there was this big things about, you know, Jews are having to leave Venezuela because of government oppression, government crackdowns, you know, et cetera. And then you start hearing this rumbling of, you know, there's going to be a regime change. I always call it regime change. Those horrible dictators that have to be overthrown, even though they were elected by the people. So Maduro, you know, suddenly becomes the next Saddam Hussein. He becomes the next Gaddafi. You know, it's that tyrant that has to be removed, and the rightful leader is our guy. And then you start hearing about Israeli involvement, Mossad involvement of training the groups a la Bay of Pigs, you know, to foment a coup d'etat and topple the government and put their new people in. And then, you know, yesterday, all of a sudden, everything, I guess it started building over the weekend and getting hotter and hotter. But by yesterday, it was, you know, we are in a full-blown coup attempt. And people like John Bolton are out there telling Maduro to, you know, step down and he better get on the plane, et cetera. And of course, he was backtracking those statements today. But, you know, that was the things you were seeing, you know, is all this saber rattling while this attempted coup was taking place. And I think to everyone's surprise, the military stayed loyal and the police forces stayed loyal to Maduro. And so now we're starting to hear these rumblings of, do we need to put U.S. boots on the ground? Do we need military intervention in Venezuela? And if so, you know, what grounds do we have to do this other than, you know, we've got to make Venezuela safe for Jewish oppression, right? So the Jews can come in and set up shop again. So it's very interesting to watch the Venezuela things. Now, granted, you know, things in Venezuela are very bad because just like under Saddam Hussein, you know, how many, you know, hundreds of thousands of children died because of the sanctions put on the U.S., put on Iraq by the U.S., you know, trade embargoes, et cetera, which is basically fourth generation warfare. You're trying in a zero sum game, you know, deprive your adversary of resource to break them, so, or to make the population so miserable they overthrow them. And, you know, you have Madeleine Albright out there saying, you know, 500,000 kids is fine, you know, it was worth it, you know, of course. So you get the same model, it's the same cookie cutter model in Venezuela. But it seems like for the time being, the military and the police are staying loyal to the same government despite all of this, you know, shadow hand covert activity on trying to undermine them. And so definitely see if we're going to be going to war in Venezuela sometime soon. One of the most bizarre stories, I guess, came out of Baltimore this week, where the Baltimore mayor had Catherine Pugh had her home and offices raided by the FBI and the IRS and several other alphabet agency, and suddenly the media is saying she's on the lam, that nobody can find her. That she, you know, basically has skipped out, even saying she's out of the state. Then her attorneys come in and say, no, she's recovering from pneumonia and is not able to make any decisions at this time, and we've got her under medical observation. And so there's a lot more to the story. The original line was that she had her offices such raided because of no bid contracts on books. And so that there was some kind of kickback deal on these book deals she was doing. And it seemed like there's a whole lot more to the story. So definitely keep your eyes open for that Baltimore mayor story. Now, we should be here for Mr. Jan Lambre. Seeing if he's here. And okay, not seeing him yet. This was supposed to be such an easy show tonight. So we're trying to locate him. Oh, there he is. Okay. So we're going to try to bring him in. Greetings.
Hi there.
Oh, good plain signal. Can you hear me okay?
I can hear you loud and clearly.
Oh, great. Well, welcome back to the Breakfast Club, good sir, Mr. Jan Lambrey from South Africa. And for those in the Breakfast Club, you know Mr. Lambrey from his work with History Reviewed, African Crisis, and he was also one of the featured speakers at this year's Fash Bash. So I'm going to let him talk about that. He's going to be giving us a rundown of his North American tour and his speaking dates and his full Pathfinder report. So welcome, good sir.
Hi there, Frederick. Yeah, it's good to be on your show.
Did we lose you?
Unexpected, but good.
Okay. All right. Trying to get back over to the chat room here and see how the audio is. But so how is everything going so far? You've been in the States for what, 2 weeks now?
Yeah. It's been good. The main reason that I've been here is because of the Fash Bash. And the guys at the Fash Bash paid my ticket to get me here. So that's the real reason that I'm here. And I was very grateful for the opportunity. And I had intended coming here next year.
Are you there?
So I was very happy that this opportunity came up. And I seized it with both hands. And I've used it to also deal with some other things that otherwise I would have left until next year. So I decided to make the most of it, and it's been interesting. And when I got here, the guys from the Fash Bash, I spent about 2 to 3 days in New York before the Fash Bash, and that was very instructive. First time I've been to New York. And it's the first time I've been to the East Coast, because I've only been here once before, and that was to the West Coast. So it was very interesting. And just looking around and just observing. So I was in many places in New York, and I was also there where the towers went down at 9/11. And I saw the Fed. And saw many other parts of New York. I was taken all over. For 2 days, we walked and were on subways all over the show. We walked about 9 miles the first day and about 11 miles the second day in between all the subways and buses that we took. So it was quite intense, but it was good. Good to see New York. It's always good to see things firsthand. And then the Fash Bash took place immediately thereafter.
So, what was your impression of New York current year?
New York? You know, America looks nice, definitely, just like last time. The country looks good, and there are many things about America that is still very functional. But the one thing that I noticed when I landed at JFK is I was immediately struck by the non-whites who you were dealing with officially. It's the first time that I've seen what you people call East Indians in America as officials and going through customs and everything. Everybody was non-white. So that was a very interesting thing. The changes to your country. Otherwise, the country itself and the town itself, like New York, actually looks nice. I mean, New York looked much more pleasant than I thought it would be, even in some of the parts where I was, which were not. I think I was in the Bronx. I was like close to. I think I was in the Bronx, and there were lots of blacks around, and it was not a good area. But compared to South Africa, it was way better than Johannesburg. If you had to compare parts of Johannesburg with the worst parts of Johannesburg with the worst parts of New York, there you'd see big differences. Big differences. Now, Johannesburg is really nasty, and Johannesburg's gone very down, but New York still looks very good. I mean, it's actually quite pleasant and quite first world. I was spending quite a bit of time counting how many, trying to estimate what the percentage of whites were who live in New York. And I'm told that the actual people who physically live there, that whites are still the majority, but when you're on the streets, whites are no longer the majority. They could make up half of the people that you see. And it was, I took lots and lots of photographs. There were many things I saw. I saw some blacks on the first day. I saw some blacks who were doing, they call themselves Black Israelites. And they believe they are the original Jews. And they were out on the street and they were very loud and carrying on and on about the Bible and how they're the real people of the Bible. I was quite fascinated by them. They were so loud about it that I wanted to then take some photos, and then suddenly they were very rather quite unpleasant about it. Then they didn't want me to take any pictures. I ran into beggars, saw beggars on the street. I saw white people begging on the street. Saw a couple of strange things where whites either on trains or on the street are begging. And then the guy Jovi, who was arranging the Fash Bash, he would say to me, "Well, in the past he's tried to help some of these people, and he's learned that many of these people are just scam artists, even the whites." We had some strange incidents with some of these people. In the one case, there was a white guy sitting on the sidewalk, and he was saying that he wants something. And when I took out my camera to take a photograph of him, he jumped up in an instant. He didn't like that at all. I just wanted a photograph of a white guy begging, that's all. And immediately was completely on the defensive. So then Jovi said to him, "Well, if you are poor and you need help, I'll get you some food." And the guy said, "Yeah, sure. He'd like some food." And so he walked with us to a short distance, and we walked into a restaurant to order some food for him. But Jovi had already warned me these people are not on the level. And so as we went in and he was busy ordering some food for the guy, I also went in, but I looked behind me and I saw the guide already turned around and walked back down the street. He wasn't interested in food.
Yeah.
And and I saw another guy begging. But on the whole, America looks very functional. And I think I can understand why Americans are not that panicky over the situation. After the Fash Bash, I headed out with some other people to Washington, D.C., because I'm actually sitting in North Carolina at the moment, and the place that I'm actually staying at the longest is here in North Carolina. And Washington, D.C. was actually much more fascinating and much more shocking than New York. In Washington, D.C., my host was saying to me, okay, see how many white people you can spot. And we were driving down the road, and kilometer after kilometer was going by. And all I was seeing was mainly blacks, but also Hispanics and Mexicans, but not a single white person in sight. And that was quite freaky for me. That was the first of the freaky things. Washington was much more freaky in that sense. I thought to myself, this is kind of weird because I also spent the night in Washington. And I thought to myself, this is rather crazy. It's never really occurred to me that America, which is basically created by white people, whites have been the majority, that if you get to their capital, that they're not the majority. Like in South Africa, despite the blacks being around everywhere, there's still quite a big white presence in the capital city of Pretoria. There are actually quite a lot of Boers actually living in Pretoria in the suburbs. And the percentage of whites in the suburbs of Pretoria is much higher than any other of the big cities. And even though it's the capital, there's actually quite a large white presence. They're not the majority, but they certainly are not a teeny weeny minority. They are there in quite large number. And here in America, you go to Washington, D.C., and you hardly see a white face. And that for me was rather freaky. And the people who lived there are actually people who came from Europe originally, and they'd lived for many years in Washington, D.C., and the husband and wife who hosted us, they had worked in many places, including some military places. And they even took us and showed me where the NSA headquarters is. They said that in the many forests around the Washington, D.C. area, there are lots of military things hidden away. And there was a lot to see there as well. And
Did they
then when
take you
we.
out to show you the echelon antennas? The big antennas off the interstate? Did you get to see those?
I don't know
Oh, you would remember them if that's one
Oh,
of
really?
the, yeah,
Okay.
it's like those are the
All I
echelon
remember
antennas.
was we drove quite a bit to the NSA buildings up and down, and you could see the off ramps for NSA. So I'm
Yeah.
not sure where the echelon antennas are. Are they close
Yeah.
to the NSA?
They're out as you're coming in on the interstate from the Virginia side. And the NSA is over, the Maryland side, the big black cubes. So it's kind of the different direction, so.
Okay, so no, then we didn't see that.
Yes.
But we were in New York, in DC itself. Among the strange sights I saw was first time in my life I've seen blacks begging while they're in electric wheelchairs. I thought that was quite a strange one. I'd never seen beggars who are sitting in electric wheelchairs. And I must tell you, some of those beggars didn't look to me like they didn't look like they had a walking problem. And as we went into and out of a restaurant, there'd be a black on a wheelchair, electric wheelchair, and he's in your face and he's busy begging. And my hosts were not very interested in them. And again, Washington, D.C. doesn't look bad. And when you get into the heart of it, we eventually got close to the White House. We could see the White House. I took a lot of photographs. There are many photographs I can put up still I took lots of photographs. I saw the White House. We could see Capitol Hill. And then I even went to see the South African embassy with the statue of the communist Nelson Mandela, and the lies about him. They were saying, oh, freedom fighter, blah blah blah. Winston Churchill was the statue across the road from the South African embassy. But we went to Jeff Bezos's house, the billionaire owner of Amazon.
Right.
He bought a house there, I think, 3 years ago for $20 million. He's not lived there. He's busy with renovations, and he's got black security guards outside his house. I went and I took some photos of that. What's it? Donald Trump's daughter, Ivana.
Yes.
We saw her house. In that part of this of Washington, there were Secret Service cars all over the show, police cars. There where the very wealthy and the very powerful live, lots and lots of police of all kinds, very much so. And there are all these scum living there in the heart of DC. On the whole, the city looks good. It looks good, but I can see why there are many things that I've sat and thought about since I've been here. I can understand why the whites here are not always panicking about the blacks, because the blacks seem civilized. They drive cars. They are still in a more or less functional city. And I think that the whites don't see any kind of impending collapse, and they are kind of used to these blacks being rather functional. My one host said that America has spent something like $1 trillion uplifting blacks since World War II. And that I don't know.
Yeah, it's amazing the amount of money that has been thrown against that problem since like the 1964 Civil Rights Act, etc., trying to bring the black community up. And it's just, and we were taught that it was possible if we just put the resources in, and that gets into that whole nature and nurture argument. That, it's all nurture, it's all nurture. If they had the right education and they had the right home life and they had money to buy food, then they could, be part of society just like everybody else. And, I think there's definitely a difference between American blacks and what we're seeing from, the sub-Saharan blacks in Africa. And a lot of people, speculate on in the early days of the slave trade, the crossbreeding of the African blacks with the Irish, that gave American blacks an IQ boost. So I always thought that was an interesting hypothesis.
Yeah, I can comment on that. I have run into blacks now in a couple of places, even here in North Carolina. And I am aware that your blacks generally have an IQ of about 15 points higher than the blacks of Africa, of Southern Africa. And in that sense, they have an IQ almost equal to that of the colored people in South Africa. But I must say, sometimes when I look at your blacks, sometimes I don't think that they're that much higher IQ, but I think they get lots of opportunities. I saw them in Walmarts and various other stores, and some of them look very unproductive. Some of them look just as unproductive as the blacks of South Africa. But I think that they've been given so many opportunities that they look like they are doing better, and they can drive better cars and they get better jobs. An interesting aspect of my visit to Washington was that our host lived And in this black area, the white guy had a really nice house, quite an expensive house. His house was probably worth about five times the value of my house in Johannesburg. And then he told me that the entire suburb, he was one of the few whites in the suburb. And then he said to me that most of the people in the suburb are blacks, that they started by buying these houses. Then the blacks didn't make their mortgage payments, but that under the Clintons and Obama, they made it so that the blacks, you can't go after the blacks. And that basically these blacks live in these really nice houses. They make no mortgage payments, and the banks are too afraid to evict them.
Right, and that was part of that whole 2008 mortgage-backed security fraud scam, and they were basically giving these mortgages to what they called subprime lenders or subprime borrowers that, these people did not have the credit rating, they did not have the means to pay these loans back, but they were giving them mortgages anyway under these groups like Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. To get, these non-whites into these white neighborhoods, and then once they were in, the market collapsed, but nobody was evicting the blacks out of those houses, and so it
Yes.
was very interesting dynamic there with the whole Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac mortgage-backed security fraud.
So I think that because your country still looks functional, and because they've been pumping a lot of, they've been helping these blacks in a thousand and one ways, I would say that the blacks in America unquestionably have had more money thrown at them than even the blacks of South Africa. And yet I don't think they've got that much to really show for it, but it's enough to fool the other whites, because when you drive in Washington, you see, every single car going past you's got a black person in it, and the car looks like a pretty decent car. So I can imagine that the whites look at these blacks and they say, "Oh, well, the blacks are the same as us." But they're not the same as you, and there's a lot of stuff that's gone into making them even achieve that little bit that they've achieved. And there were places we drove through where my host pointed out, look at the doors. If you see a security door with bars on it, then the neighborhood is bad, and so on. But I'd still say that even what you regard as bad is not the same as what is bad in South Africa. That there, when the blacks fall in Africa, they fall much further down. But having said that, I think the your blacks have had lots of help, really lots of it.
Oh, yeah.
And their attitude is also quite different. They're much more arrogant, they're physically bigger. But in the few discussions I had with some of them, I don't think they're actually that much cleverer. I don't think they're that much cleverer, actually. But I can see why whites aren't panicking in America. And there's a lot of stuff about America when I look at it, it reminds me of South Africa, the 1980s, definitely. I noticed when people go to get the mail, lots of stuff coming in the mail, free catalogs, free magazines, not only the things you ordered, but the many things you didn't order. And there's lots and lots of stuff to choose from, stacks of things to buy. And that is very much like South Africa in the 1980s. South Africa used to be like that. Mail order business was big. All kinds of businesses would get you on their mailing list without you knowing about it, and they'd be posting you stuff and offering you products. And now in South Africa, 30, 35 years later, all those things are dead and gone. They're gone. You don't get mail order catalogs in the mail anymore. All those businesses are dead because the economy has gone downhill, and all the many risks that the business people could take, and the money that they could throw at all kinds of business enterprises are now gone. But in America, clearly there's still lots of money around, and they can do it. And I went to the Walmarts. Walmarts are very impressive. Got lots of stores with lots of things in them, and the Walmarts to me are particularly impressive. You can buy virtually anything there, and it's very cheap. However, as I've discovered in South Africa, you've got to be careful of these big businesses. These big stores are anti-white, and these big stores move into an area, and they are going to kill other smaller businesses. Other white businesses will go out of business. And that has been what's been happening in South Africa for decades, for the last 35 years. Big Jewish businesses have moved in. They've come in with high capital, big enterprises, cheaper goods. Everybody rushes to buy from them, but you're actually busy killing other white businesses off. And when the
Exactly.
other white businesses are dead, then you're going to find that these big businesses start ordering you around. And they're going to tell you, you can't do this, you mustn't do that, you must bend to the blacks. And I think Americans are falling into the same trap the South Africans fell into, exactly the same trap. You think capitalism is the solution, and you're looking at Jewish monopolistic successes, and you're saying, wow, this is an indication of how healthy the country is. The danger is that those businesses that you're supporting, that you are liking, they are actually going to be working against you.
Right. And that was one of the, we did a show a while back about the Walmart model and how Walmart would just go in and use fourth generation warfare tactics to, force its way into these towns despite the local businesses saying this is going to destroy our businesses that are family owned, been here for generations, the local hardware store, the local pharmacy, the local, dress shops, et cetera. And Walmart comes in, gets their way, and just like everybody says, all the brick and mortar shops go under because they can't compete. And then the Walmarts either close up shop and then the town has to deal with the empty building, derelict building, or suddenly your Walmart is full with all of this, Chinese slave labor gear. After, Walmart originally said that they were going to sell American-made products and put Americans back to work, et cetera. But once, they got in place, then I can't find anything in a Walmart that's made in America anymore. It's always, made in China, made here, made in Mexico, et cetera. So there's that part of it. Is internet shopping huge in South Africa? People that still have enough money to buy stuff, do they buy things from like Amazon, or do you still have brick and mortar shops?
In South Africa, you don't have as much online shopping as here, mainly because there aren't as many and because the infrastructure is not the same. This is one of the differences. There are similarities and yet differences between America and South Africa. And like, for example, because your country is still functional in so many ways, there are things that you've got that are still functioning that stopped functioning in South Africa a long time ago. I'll give you an example. Checks. You people can write out checks. You can pay your bills by taking a check, throwing it in the mail, and off it goes. The mail is going to arrive. The check is going to arrive there safely, and they're going to go and deposit the check. Now, we stopped using checks in South Africa probably 20 to 25 years ago. We don't have checks at all. And in America, people can even send money. I've seen Americans even send cash in the mail. That disappeared probably 30 years ago in South Africa because the mail became so unreliable because they were stealing so much. They steal so much that that even the banks stopped sending credit cards out in the mail. They stopped sending out credit, even credit cards, because even that was just falling apart. So in South Africa, if you get a credit card, you have to physically go to a banking branch to collect your credit card. They used to send credit cards in the mail 40 years ago in South Africa. They can't do that anymore. So things like checks, things like cash, money orders in the mail, everything that used to go through the mail, and the mail was so useful and reliable and so cheap, all of that disappeared because the South African postal system, had so many blacks in it, and the blacks were just stealing, and they just couldn't control it. So you've still got things that are functioning that have ceased to function in South Africa decades ago. And they've tried every trick in the book. Even the big businesses couldn't get it to function, and eventually they had to abandon it. So that is why in your country you can still do online shopping, you can still buy things online because you've got a functioning postal system. And I discovered that you've got like special media rates and certain things. If you buy books, you can get the books to be shipped at a nice cheap price through the postal system. So because you've got a functioning postal system, you can still do online sales in a big way. But the moment that your postal system goes downhill, then probably in the decades to come, you're going to run into problems there. Unless you can have some kind of technology that still allows your postal system to function without it being compromised that much. But I mean, in this little town where I am currently, I went and I met the postal worker. He was a white guy, and it was nice to go to a nice clean post office. I think it must be close to 35 or 40 years ago, that probably 35 years ago, that I last saw a white guy working in a post office and in South Africa. And when I went to the post office again today, I saw there was a black there. So I'm told that little by little they are pushing the blacks in everywhere. And just talking to the locals here, a white neighbor said she's got a new boss. The new boss is black. However, in this county where I am, the blacks make up probably, I'd have to do a quick calculation, but the blacks are probably 10% of the population. Yet blacks are being pushed in everywhere. So your country is changing. Your country is definitely changing for the worse, bit by bit. But it's just not happened on as big a scale as South Africa.
Right, and the strategy is they called it affirmative action, and big businesses have to have quotas of non-whites throughout the board, and so it's a means to bring in non-white populations into these white areas in federal jobs because we have to meet our quotas. Then you get the big box stores like Walmart's and Lowe's and Home Depot and things like that, and they also have to have their quotas, and so they have to bring these people in. And so here in North Carolina, that basically the line is white men need not apply for any work because you're not going to get the job. You're going to be the last one that they consider because of all these diversity quotas, etc. And this little town in the mountains of North Carolina is a perfect example of that. Supposedly this town is 90% white, but if you go to the Walmart, you'll be hard pressed to see a white local person working at that Walmart. And the same thing on campus now, that's a state funded university, but that was one of the things they sold this area to, that we'll bring in this college here and it'll provide jobs for the local people. Well, now the local people can't get a job at the university because they have to bring in this globo national, non-white hiring base. And that's the big model. So, it's definitely coming. And like I always say, South Africa is the template for the rest of the white nations. You're seeing the same models, and it's just South Africa is further along because they were the sandbox, like you said, in this, I think it'll run up in the 70s and then really push in the 80s and 90s with a full-blown anti-white agenda. That's what we've got going on here.
I do have something else I want to tell you, is that, in the case of South Africa, the agenda was pushed by the blacks, the communists, the Jews, the liberals, the international community. Advanced communists who are actually part and parcel of your system. And it amazes me the kinds of things that they manage to get into your country sort of ahead of schedule, like all this affirmative action and racial quotas. Your country's not being taken over by blacks, yet you already have racial quotas, and the racial quotas were instituted by, let's call it whites. And it astounds me the sophistication of your local communists and Jews and liberals, in that they've managed to come up with the bogus reasons why you need to change your country and push it so far along this racial communist agenda. And I can understand now, again, why white Americans are not concerned, because they come up with so many cunning arguments that seem to hold water, but in fact don't hold water. Just like you were saying with the mortgages, saying, oh well, you got to help these people, and if you help them, they'll be better, and so on. But in actual fact, that is a lie, and that ignores other examples. It's not like blacks have never had opportunities in Africa or other places. Blacks have had many opportunities, in Haiti and all sorts of other locations. Blacks have ruled themselves for 200 years. They've had all kinds of opportunities, and to now pretend that they've never had a chance and you need to help them in this thing. Your communists and your Jews and your liberals are very cunning in that sense, and they've found the kind of wording that works on your people, and they've managed to get away with a lot of victim nonsense as the basic excuse, which is actually to prepare you for your own destruction. And I myself, in the 1980s in South Africa, I also fell for some of these things. And, I used to look at big business, for example. And I used to look at big business and the success of business and how efficient business was. And I used to think business is superior to communism. And I used to marvel at its power. I used to marvel at how it could survive all sorts of things, how it could get things done, how it could function without government control. I used to believe that business was the answer to everything. I truly used to believe that in the 1980s and deep into the 1990s and even afterwards. But I'll tell you, in the last five and more years, I've changed my views a lot on that. I no longer believe that. And I look back on the things that I did, for example, bringing in the non-whites. Now you're told, bring in the non-whites, train the non-whites in your job. Train them because they need to learn so that they can also be like you, so that they can also be functional. But you're actually training the very people that are going to replace you. And you are actually helping up the very people who are going to destroy you. And these businesses are coming in and they are laying the groundwork for your destruction. But they don't say it in that way. They use all this victim nonsense and liberal nonsense as the basis for that. But in actual fact, it's a one-way street. The white person is working to destroy himself. And that is the most astounding thing about South Africa and big business. And it's a total repeat here in America. It's exactly the same thing. And I used to really believe business was a sign of success. But now I look on business and I say to myself, why is it that Amazon dominates? How is it that Amazon or PayPal dominates? And I now say to myself, isn't it due to the Jew? How much of big business success is actually real, and how much of it is just a Jewish smokescreen? And I'll give you, there was something else that came to mind, and pardon me, I've forgotten it. It'll come back again. But truly, I used to think that business was a sign of success and that the free market existed. But now that I'm older and wiser, I realize that the free market doesn't exist. The free market exists at the lower levels when you have a mom-and-pop store. It exists at the lower levels when you've got white guys owning farms and each one is busy working on his farm and producing what he can. But it's not the same thing when a huge chain of supermarkets comes in and they are super capitalized and they just come and kill all the other businesses. Exactly like you said, like my host here in North Carolina. We went to the Walmart, and he himself, he knows what's going on, and he says, well, it's amazing what you can get here, but it will also destroy the local businesses, all these businesses that you see across the road from it. Give it a couple of years, they will all be dead. And this is where Adolf Hitler, a German friend of mine told me that Adolf Hitler went and he banned chains of supermarkets, chains of stores.
Exactly.
And you know what? Adolf Hitler was dead right, because you cannot compete against them. And I used to view capitalism as a great successful system, but now I say to myself, how are you and I going to compete against these banks? How are we going to compete against Walmart or any of these other businesses? You'll see that these businesses are basically, their basic edge over us is capital. Capital. They walk in with huge amounts of capital, but not just capital, also all their business connections that they've got. So they not only have the capital, but they're also part of a bigger network. They got access to every single thing. And when they move into a place, they can just go and out. They will defeat everybody, not because they're better, but because they are benefiting from massive economies of scale. So they're going to drive everyone out because they've got a, it's a completely, it's not a level playing field at all. And that's how they're going to crush everybody. That is why, for example, I ponder, the American farmer. White families used to have farms across this country, just like whites in Africa had. And in your country, farmers have been driven out by big business. So big business is destroying farms, it's destroying mom-and-pop stores, it's destroying all kinds of small industries. However, what's keeping you going is that you've still got a large white population. And because you've got quite a large white population and a big economy, you can still trade even though there are lots of things that are against you. You've still got a wider, bigger audience that you can appeal to. So you can still manage to function simply because you're part of a much bigger thing. And they can't crush everybody out just yet. But it's coming. It's
Yeah.
coming.
And that's one of the big learning curves, I guess, is seeing how economic models changed after World War II, and this idea of fourth generation warfare, especially during the Cold War and post-Cold War, but the idea of in fourth generation warfare, anything and everything can be weaponized. Your legal system can be weaponized. Your trade system can be weaponized. Your banking system can be weaponized. And this is what we have seen in this run-up is, you know, everything has been weaponized against family business, white business, in favor of this globalist Jewish capital business. And you know, you're talking about the root of capital, who has the money to invest. And it's like, well, when you're the Federal Reserve printing money out of nothing and loaning it to the United States to, you know, and charging interest on the use of that money and creating just unbelievable wealth in the hands of these few globalist Jews like the Rothschilds, the Warburgs, the Cohn-Loebs, the Goldman Sachs, etc., and then they pick up, you know, their Jeff Bezos, their Facebook's, Zuckerberg's type guys, and set them up, your PayPal guys, and, you know, you have nobody on the white side that can set anybody up to compete with them. And it's just kind of like the Freemason model where basically you either join or you will be run out of business. And that was the big push with the Freemason models in the United States is you get these local business owners to join. And then it's kind of like this syndicate where if you're not Freemason, then we will run you out of business. The newspaper will be against you. All the government agencies will be against you. The other businesses will be against you. And it's either you join or die. And you know, so now we've expanded that to this globalist model where, you know, it's this international Jewish cabal deciding who gets to do business and who doesn't.
Yes, yes. This is not free market capitalism. But we have been conditioned, we whites in our various countries, we've all been conditioned to believe that success is a sign of the health and power of capitalism. But in actual fact, the reality is that success is actually very limited and you are not going to be a part of it. You think that you're going to get a chance in it, but you are not going to get a chance in it. And so the whites don't see the danger of this thing that's coming. But the Jews and those people in that model, they already know. They already know the future, and they know that they don't want you to be part of that future. And they're already positioning themselves for it. And you know, in your country also, you've had communists at various points in the past. I stand to be corrected, but I think people have said that Woodrow Wilson was one of the first communist leaders in this country. And Roosevelt was definitely a commie surrounded by commies. And you guys have had communists in this country, but you've also not gone and hung them from – you've not gone and put a rope around their necks. So these communists may have been defeated and pushed back in certain ways, but they've still existed. And of course, you get this Frankfurt School of Communists from Germany. And these communists and Jews and scum, they've all come and while living among you, they've observed you carefully. And eventually they've found the weaknesses that they can play against you. And basically, I'd say they've played the victim game. They found that the victim thing works best, the guilt trip and the victim trip. Like in this town where I am, in this region, there are lots of Christians. The people are Christians on a large scale. So they are actually very placid and very like the Boers. So they're falling for very similar kinds of things. And it's something else. You talk about the Freemasons. One of the areas where I was always deficient on was the Freemasons. I'd heard of the Freemasons. I even knew one guy who was a Freemason, and I'd spoken to him a bit. But at the end of last year, when I was beginning with my work on my lectures in South Africa, when I was starting to travel, I was running into a guy who was quite a high-ranking Freemason. And just in the course of just sitting and chatting and being in his presence with other people and him being open about being a Freemason, he would start talking about it and he would boast about it, and he even brought his Freemason stuff so that we could see what levels he'd attained and all that. We even took some photos of his various certificates and things, and we'd ask him questions. And it was while I was talking to him that I began to realize that other South African friends of mine were right, that Freemasonry is actually a big problem in South Africa. And when I was listening to him and he was starting to tell me about how many Freemason lodges there were in South Africa, I began to realize that South Africa in the past must have been, South Africa definitely had been overflowing with Freemasons. Definitely. And interestingly enough, in talking to him, I came to realize that Freemasonry, at least in South Africa, also has a very Christian angle to it, but it's a Christian globalist liberal outlook on life. It's definitely not racialist. And in talking to him about his decades as a Freemason, this guy told me all kinds of things, and he even told me that blacks are now becoming Freemasons. That in actual fact, black presidents from other countries in Africa are becoming Freemasons, and they're coming to South Africa or joining other Freemason lodges. So I must tell you, in the last couple of months, in the last 6 months, I've had quite an education in Freemasonry in South Africa, and unquestionably, Freemasonry has been a system that has rotted the white mind of South Africa. There must be stacks and stacks and stacks of whites who were Freemasons, because it's clear from all his descriptions of the lodges that there must have been unbelievable numbers of Freemasons in South Africa. And these Freemasons would be inundated with liberal, Jewish, globalist types of thinking, which are anti-white, anti-nationalist, anti-patriotic. And judging from what you're saying, sounds to me like you've got a similar problem here in America.
Oh,
And
definitely.
these things should be shut down. Adolf Hitler with the Gestapo was busy shutting down all these secret societies. Again, Adolf Hitler was doing the right thing.
Right. And, I've done a lot of shows on the Freemasons and how they're basically fifth columns for this New World Order model. And it's a Jewish model. It has become a Jewish model. Of this, they call it the Babylon model, the seven-layer model of, the different perfect goyim. They're trying to have the perfect worker bee society, and when you ask a Freemason, what they're trying to do, create the perfect Ashlar and build the third temple in Jerusalem. Those are their end games. We've got to have the third temple in Jerusalem, and we've got to fix the world with this, international brotherhood thing. And it's.
Yes, exactly. I could see that these guys had deep beliefs in these Jews being the original, being the people of God, and this tremendous tying back to Israel. And like you say, this international brotherhood, you don't look out for white people, you're part of the whole world. And I had a lot of interesting discussions with this high-ranking Freemason, trying to see what exactly is wrong with his mind. Why is he buying into it? And I got to tell you that these kinds of things, these things are definitely a killer for white society. You're going to struggle to save your country with these things so deeply embedded. But now, of course, Freemasonry comes with comes with all the links to money. And if you are truly a successful Freemason, and this is one of the stories I heard in South Africa, somebody else was telling me about a Freemason who, there were Freemasons even in the rural areas. And one of the Freemasons, I was told, owned something like 27 farms. So when you are a properly well-situated Freemason, you have enormous amounts of money, you've got massive financial clout, and you've got lots of power at a local level. And these people are dangerous. These people are anti the country, and they're anti the whites. And it's all very subtle, and people regard them as stable, honest, good members of society. But they are representing a power that is working to destroy the nation.
Right. And yeah, most Freemasons don't understand that white genocide, the clergy plan, is part of the Freemason endgame. They don't tell you that before you take your blood oath. Most of them never even figure it out that, you know, the Jewish model is that mongrel slave, you know, global model with Greater Israel and Pax Judaica being the ruling capital of the world from Jerusalem, and everybody living under Talmudic Noahide law globally. That is the Freemason model. But most of them just think it's a social organization until you make business contacts and you become successful and you become good, upstanding leaders in your community. You know, that was what I was brought up with. Well, in the few minutes we have left, tell us the rest of your tour. Are you going to be doing any more lectures, or are you just going to sightsee and visit for the rest of your trip?
I've got some more serious work that I'm busy looking at over here. I'm busy trying to help out some guys who have a certain problem that I want to see if I can turn it into a small opportunity. I'm still not quite sure, so I'm actually doing quite a bit of work on that while I'm here. I am very open to doing lectures, to going to places, to meeting people. I'm probably going to be here at least until the end of May, possibly even early June. And so if there are people who want me to meet them and who would like to have me give a lecture or speak to them, I'm very much open to that. If they can communicate with me via you, that is quite fine. I would welcome it. I do have a little plan, but I don't want to discuss it now. I have got a week that is planned where I'm going to go and talk to some groups of people, but I'm not going to mention any details about that. There has been some talk. There were some people that were talking to me also about organizing a little event in another part of your country. But for the most part, my schedule is open, and I would welcome any opportunities that can be made to meet people and talk to people and speak to people while I'm here. I would say it's very possible that I'll be here until the first week of June. So if there's still opportunities, then let's make it happen. I'd like to meet as many people as I can and get my message to as many people as possible.
All right. And again, the websites where people can look at your work?
My main website is historyreviewed.com and africancrisis.info. Historyreviewed.com, africancrisis.info.
Great. All right. Well, once again, Mr. Jan Lambre, thank you so much for being on the show and giving us such a great Pathfinder report out there in the trenches. So, it's just fascinating observations. And again, welcome to the U.S. I hope you enjoy the rest of your stay. And hopefully we can hook up before you go back. Any last words you want to leave with the crew?
You can rest assured that all the time that I'm here, I'm watching and learning and observing, and I will I will add more observations, later. I'm trying my best to understand the situation. I think the final word that I'd say is this: don't feel bad about the fact that you are unable to convert the rest of the whites in this country to your viewpoint. You are up against millionaires, billionaires, and entire global systems that are stacked against you. And you should just hang in there and do what you can. It is very logical that the normal whites are not listening to you, but don't let that get you down. It's critically important to get your message to them. And I will do what I can from my side to assist and to give any input that I can. And I also hope to be back in America in a much shorter period of time rather than the 9 year break since I was here last.
All right. Well, thank you again for coming on the show, and we'll be in touch. All right. So, thank again for everyone coming out this evening. I hope everyone has a wonderful week. And until next time, I will see you all at the rendezvous.